everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast again. Today we're going to be talking about Madagascar, and I really wanted to do a show on Madagascar because there's some exciting things happening in the country at the moment and possibly for the future of the country. So we're going to talk about Madagascar a bit, and I'm very happy to have Dr. Richard Marcus on the line with me, and he is the professor and director at the Global Studies Institute and the International Studies Program at California State Long Beach, and he's also the forthcoming author of The Politics of Institutional Change in Madagascar's Third Republic. So when that comes out, we will definitely let our listeners know. But thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Marcus.
My pleasure.
So let's just get a brief overview of Madagascar's political history at this point. They've had a very interesting political history in many, many years from now until in the past as well. So why don't you give me a little brief idea of what this country has gone through?
Sure. And I think very briefly, it's worth going backwards quite a bit as we see some trends that have continued. So if I can go back just a little bit, first that Madagascar is not really part of Africa, not really part of Asia. And most people who are Malgache consider themselves neither really. That it was colonized by the French is also quite important. However, while the French colonization period started in 1896, it was different than a lot of other former Francophone, sort of former French colonies, in that it was mostly a centralized country under a monarchy before that, under a Mandarin monarchy starting at the end of the 18th century. And also, both prior to the monarchy and through the monarchical period, there was high interaction between European powers, and in fact, with European powers supporting different monarchical forces on the island. And it's important today because it influenced the different identity roles that we see and how they play out today, and the way that the Mandarin population plays into the economy or the like is very important because of this long embedded history.
So let's actually, as you mentioned the economy now, I mean, let's look at the economy, the economic situation in Madagascar, because as we mentioned, it's had a very rift political environment in the last number of years. So how has that affected the economy of this small island country?
The economy of Madagascar is really a quite tragic story because it is a country that is very rich in resources and has had so many opportunities. And when I say so many opportunities, I again want to be historic about it and say we can turn back the clock and look at nearly a century ago at some of the opportunities that were missed and then sort of mile markers along the way. Part of the issue is that Madagascar's history can in part, or its political history can in part, be told through its social movements. And as progress has been made, then both politically and economically, then social movements have turned away some of the economic progress. So speaking specifically to the current period, and since 2009, poverty is up about 8% in the period from 2009 to 2013. There's a very significant urban-rural divide in the country already, in a country that is something about 79% rural. There's a significant urban-rural divide, and that's been exacerbated since 2009 with poverty increasing in rural areas faster than in urban areas. Agriculture has been a dominant part of the economy, but has really suffered. So it suffered in two ways. It suffered in terms of arable land and access for subsistence agriculture, but also in yields it's suffered. So rice, the food staple, for instance, ranges in yields from 1 to 1.5 tons per hectare, which is really quite low, and it's diminished a lot. So the decline in arable land has had that impact as well. It's been particularly hard in the south of the country. In the south, in Andjuri, for instance, where I've done quite a bit of work, there's long-standing water crisis. Most people think about Madagascar for its rainforests, and it certainly has these important rainforests, but it also has these semi-arid and arid regions in the south. And so there's this long-standing water crisis, and in fact, In the early part of the French period, the then French governor hired a French general to go around to different parts of the country and look at ways in which they can control the population. And one of the things that was reported back was, in the South, if you can control the water, you can control the population. And the recommendation was actually to build a water system because you can control the population. So while obviously that sounds very sort of devious today, the point about the water issue being so extreme was recognized a century ago, and it is still a pervasive issue that's not been dealt with, and in times of poverty becomes more dramatic. Also, as a result of that that poverty, state capacity has declined rather significantly. There's a lot of discussion of sort of state fragility, but I think about it more as state unraveling. It's not like it's about to break. It's more that the capacity of the state to govern across sectors has diminished, and that includes security outside of the capital region, amongst other things. So that means that in the South, in Anjou, for instance, there's less capacity to protect the citizenry, and there has been a pretty significant increase in insecurity over the past year or so as a result directly of the economic situation. Just a couple more things on the economy and these impacts in the last few years. That state capacity issue that I mentioned has taken a real toll in social sectors like health and education, where there were modest gains in the mid-2000s in these social sectors. We saw that nearly fall apart, and so the health and education sector just start to unravel. The level of desperation is very high now in comparison to 6 or 7 years ago. The amount of hope has significantly diminished, even with the elections, which have brought some new hope for sure. There's this lack of hope that's of great concern. In measurable indices, this has continued to be a problem, with the UNDP's Human Development Index scoring, for instance, showing Madagascar sliding at about, I think it's 151 out of 187 countries now in the UNDP's index. So a very poor country to begin with, falling further. And my last point on this is, there's some other UN data that is pointed towards increases in vulnerability. And that sort of vulnerability has changed the way the international community thinks about Madagascar, for sure, and the way the donors are approaching Madagascar. But it impacts the daily lives of the population, both in urban sectors and in rural sectors, because vulnerability in urban and rural areas means that humanitarian concerns outweigh development concerns.
And when you talk about vulnerability concerns, are we talking about actual threats of attack in certain regions, or are we talking more about corruption as we see in a lot of other countries?
Actually, I'm speaking economically at this moment, and we can speak to those other issues as well. But Madagascar, I think, is miraculous in some ways in the amount of stability that it's maintained through very significant times. And I was speaking to economic vulnerability of the population, mm-hmm. an ability to obtain food or health care or basic needs of life. And so we see sort of raw index scores become very problematic for, you know, what it's like for children under the age of 5 or getting vaccinations or like I said before, obtaining food as there's been food shortages or access to clean water, these sorts of things. That's when I speak to vulnerability. I was thinking in terms of the economy and poverty increases and what that's meant in, again, both urban and rural sectors.
All right. Thank you for clearing that up. So let's look at Madagascar's, I mean, as you said, it has a long political history, but let's look at Madagascar's political history since maybe the 2000s onward.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's been quite interesting. And, I mean, we had, let's see, Marc Ravalomanana. I'm hoping I'm not going to destroy these names because they're quite difficult. But he was a democratically elected president of Madagascar. And then there was a period of conflict in 2002. Well, this was after the 2002 conflict that he was democratically elected. So give us a little bit idea of his presidency and the paving moments of his presidency.
Sure. So So I'll go back to that 2002 period for a moment. So the election in 2001 was Didier Ratsirak versus Marco Ravalomanana, ultimately. And the question at the time, and this is in December of 2001, was not whether Marco Ravalomanana won a majority of the votes. The question was, did he win more than 50% and therefore avoid a second round election? There were a lot of various events leading up to it. It was a point in history of not despair, but concern both in the populace and the international community, in large part because Didier Ratsirak, he was actually the scientific socialist, not democratic leader from 1975 until the constitutional change in 1992-93. And he came back as a Democrat. And when he came back in the late 1990s, he started to return sort of a flavor of the Second Republic. And so the concerns were during that period that he was going to monopolize those elections and not allow Ravalomanana to win. So Ravalomanana, Didier Ratsirak responded to that electoral process by making it an opaque vote counting process. Ravalomanana responded by having these extremely organized, extremely large street protests in Antananarivo in January of 2002. This grew into a national movement, predominantly urban social movement, in 2002, until such a time when essentially, Didier Ratsirak was pushed out. He went into self-imposed exile in France, and Ravalomanana was declared the winner of the elections 6 months after they ended, and he was installed as president. So that began the period in sort of a rocky way for Ravalomanana. At the time, the African Union then said, okay, well, this was all pretty messy. So in order to accept the results of this election, we want to see some pretty good legislative elections, which they then did see in that following December. And what those elections led to was a rise of Ravalomanana's new party. So in essence, Ravalomanana came to be a very strong leader in the executive, but also have a significant influence in the legislature as well. So that was how he began his presidency in 2002. And he was seen by the international community as a new Democrat, as a great hope, as an African example of a new Democrat, and donors flocked to him, and perhaps deservedly so. He was at the same time this charismatic leader and doing things that were really the right thing for Madagascar, at the same time that he was doing a lot of things that were right for him. He came out of the private sector. He was a self-made man, very wealthy man from the private sector. He had this very free flow between benefits to Tiko, his umbrella company, and the government. And in a lot of ways, while we speak often to the way in which presidents benefit privately by, giving contracts or something to their own companies, and while there was that sort of problem, there was the reverse as well that was very significant of the private sector role that he had in Tiko, really benefiting him politically in all sorts of different ways. And the free flow of personnel, of thinking, of leadership style between the private sector and the public space of being president came to really characterize the presidency of Marco Ravalomanana in that period of 2002 to 2006, until that time in 2006 when he went up for re-election. Most analysts, I think, would say that 2006 was a there was a landmark change in the leadership of Marco Ravalomanana. Now, he continued to be this sort of good technocrat in the sense of reforms to key sectors. But there really was only Ravalomanana. Like, there was no challenge to him or his thinking, either from the legislature or from the executive. So while he was democratically elected, for sure, and he was democratically reelected in 2006, there really was no great challenge to his voice. I should add to that as elections went on, again, legislative elections, followed by regional elections, local elections, there was no opposition voice present other than ultimately the mayoral elections that produced Andrew Aswan that followed. Before that, there was this period of time where really Ravalomanana was there was no voice in any sort of part of the body politic. And that was really one of the structural concerns in the country during that time period. And that's really what set the possibility for the political instability that we ultimately saw in 2009, was there was no space for voice. Now, again, he was democratically elected, and that needs to be recognized. But at the same time, the concern of the opposition was that there was no challenge to him. It became a near imperial presidency, both in terms of constitutional powers and the ways in which the president actuated those powers.
So coming to that point, we have 2009 when it's sort of the breaking point, and we have this coup that takes place. So why don't you explain the background of this coup, which ultimately sent Madagascar down a very different path than it previously had been, both internationally and, of course, domestically for the country?
So I'll try to quickly say this is a really important question. And so let me try to break it into three parts of, one, the sort of structural concerns I started talking about, two, the triggers for that, and then three, the this is what happened kind of question, right? So the first part of the structural one, what I was saying before about the political space being super narrow with, again, a near imperial presidency, a very weak legislature, a judiciary that was insufficient at virtually all levels. I think it's important that in Madagascar, the constitution has been extremely malleable. With one interim exception, every president in the modern history of Madagascar has changed the constitution to suit his needs. So it's not seen as a guiding document. Jurisdictional powers have been one of the things that's contested. So Ravalomanana, for instance, changed the power structure from being one of provinces, jurisdictionally speaking, to one of regions. And he did so actually in 2004 without a constitutional change, and then the constitution caught up in 2007, meaning that even what constitutes regional government was unclear. Civil society is pretty weak in Madagascar. Associational life is strong. That is, people get together to do stuff, but they don't become a political force very easily. Political networks tend to dominate the political landscape. Those very personalized relationships in the body politic are very, very important. The party politics law has long been problematic, and political parties have been inchoate in Madagascar. They've been really just a vehicle for leaders. So there's these very significant structural problems that were really being recognized in the 2000s, some of which were brought about by Ravalomanana, others of which have been longstanding in Madagascar. Combined with Ravalomanana's leadership style, which was again very singular, a rise in religious and often pseudo-religious tension, that is, the creation of religious tension for political purposes as opposed to real religious tensions, and different kinds of institutional blockages. And as I mentioned before, the moving back and forth the president would do between his company, TICO, and the government created these sort of structural concerns that allowed room for triggers to mount, right, or to take importance. So moving to those triggers then, there was a very real one. There was a very real curtailment of freedoms in the post-2006 era, and in particular in 2007-08 into early 2009, and that raised a lot of concerns, and in particular in the capital. Perhaps the one that got the most press was a potential or pending contract with Daewoo Logistics between the government and Daewoo Logistics, a Korean company that was looking to lease a large amount of arable land in Madagascar. And more important, the contract was never signed, but more important than the contract itself might be that it was done in this very sort of secretive manner, and the president didn't bring in a larger circle into that conversation. Less impacting, but nonetheless important in the press, was that the president ordered an Air Force One, which he called in English, an Air Force One. That is, he wanted a presidential jet that, while in and of itself wouldn't bankrupt a country, it was seen as him being out of touch with where the economy was headed, the idea that he would order this fancy jet for himself. And then there was the question of poverty as a trigger. And with poverty, I think it's important to look at what are the perceived realities and what are the actual distribution questions, because poverty actually went down fairly significantly during the Ravalomanana years, but it went down at a slower rate than GDP went up. So what that meant was the gap between the rich and the poor got bigger even at a time when poverty was decreasing. And the public view, and in particular the urban public view, was that a bunch of people are getting really rich off these different areas, and we're not. And things are getting worse for us. So those are sort of the triggers that allowed some of these things to take place in sort of end 2008, early 2009, and ultimately the overthrow of Ravalomanana. Okay, so the last part of that I wanted to mention was the storyline of March 2009 and leading up to it, which was, it's a very murky storyline. Usually when we speak to coups, we speak to a relatively organized army storming the palace gates and taking over. And it wasn't that clean, right? Again, it's a rather murky storyline, starting with, like it started long before, but at least starting with December 13th, 2008, when Ravalomanana shut down the radio station, TV station of then mayor, Andrew Rajoelina, followed shortly thereafter on January 17th, this sort of ongoing tension between the mayor's office and the president's office, that the mayor wanted to institute a new square, a Place de la Democratie, and the president wouldn't let him, and he said, "That's not your job. This is an urban square. And as mayor, this is my decision." And the president said, "I can say no. This is the capital." And they had this sort of tension. And the mayor did, after all, institute Place de la Democratie. And that was a lightning rod moment, in as much as much of the opposition rallied around Rajoelina to sort of swear in the square and make these sort of speeches, showing that they were willing to unseat Ravalomanana, even though he was democratically elected. That was followed by a period of strikes led by Andrew Rajoelina in the end of January, 24th, 25th, which then very rapidly turned violent. The ultimate moment probably came, though, on February 7th, when there was a relatively peaceful demonstration in front of the presidential palace, and the palace guards opened fire with live bullets on those demonstrators, and the numbers are not clear, but something around 28 people were killed and probably about 100 or so were wounded. This really was a moment where credibility for President Ravalomanana was lost, that his legitimacy was significantly undermined in a country where that sort of thing just doesn't happen. The idea of firing on citizenry is not something that really happens in Madagascar. Shortly thereafter, there was a couple of failed dialogues between Ravalomanana and Rajoelina. And we saw the what seemed like a pretty sudden intervention by one faction of the military, CAPSAT, which was the Administrative and Technical Services of the military, which really demonstrated that the military itself was highly factionalized, and one small piece could break off and start to support Rajoelina. And that became critical to his ability to rise, because he needed military support if he was going to rise in power and if Ravalomanana was going to be pushed out. So during that period, Ravalomanana removed Rajoelina as mayor of the capital, which Rajoelina in turn said the president doesn't have the power to do, as he was democratically elected. A faction of the army took over the presidential palace by March 16th of 2009. And then this sort of murky period still, where Ravalomanana was under great duress, but also didn't follow the constitutional process. So on the one hand, he didn't follow the constitutional process, but on the other hand, he was under great duress. He tried to hand power over to a military leader. That failed. CAPSAT officers ended up taking power and handing that power over to Rajoelina. That whole storyline is a very murky storyline with a lot of blame to go around to a lot of different people. And no one handled things really well. And the public view was quite different than the international community view. The public view at the time in Madagascar was neither one nor the other. That is, you you can say, I don't want either of these guys, and especially because they're both Merina, we don't want either of these guys, as opposed to the international view, which at least in the immediate aftermath said the only way to return to constitutionality would be for the restoration of Rafa Lamanana. And that was not taken very well in the capital, generally speaking. Again, in that time period, at least. So we can say during that time period that Wajdalana was pretty intransigent. He argued that he came through the streets just like Ravalomanana did in 2002. But, of course, Ravalomanana went through election and he didn't, so it was really quite different. We can say that Ravalomanana overplayed his hand, he overstepped his authority, and he really seemed out of touch with how isolated he'd become. And we can say that the international community arguably exacerbated the situation early on. The local population in Madagascar was sitting there saying, well, if you're going to stop funding, that hurts us, not the government. Why are you blaming us for what our leaders are doing? And that was sort of public sentiment and not quite sure why the international community was doing what it was doing. So anyway, that's what I would say about that period, that very murky period of the early 2009.
So, I mean, this new power take of Rajlina, I'm trying to pronounce it the way you do, but it pretty much isolated the country from the international community, as you mentioned just briefly already, and it really deprived this country of foreign aid. So, I mean, how did that affect Madagascar?
Yeah, in two ways. The donor community works in coordination with but separate from the diplomatic community, right? For the donor community, speaking of the donor community, most of the donor community very rapidly froze aid. And again, very rapidly. And so what we saw was from, you know, that period in March 2009 until we measure again in 2010, funding drop was 29% less than it was before the crisis or so. It was very, very rapid cuts. And perhaps made worse by the way in which the cuts happened. That is, there was a shift in where that funding went that increased the impact of those cuts. So areas such as water and transport and energy and communication, areas like that that were supported by the international community just plummeted. Financial sectors, mining, industry, commerce. Had significant areas of support from the international community, and that dropped. Environment, again, this is a critical country globally as we think about the uniqueness of the flora and the fauna and how we think about environmentalism in Madagascar. And there's been a history of very significant budget support for the environment sector in Madagascar from the donor community. That got cut almost in half, almost overnight. And then direct budgetary support was cut from something almost $100 million to about $5 million, again, almost overnight. So a very, very significant cut very rapidly. So those sorts of cuts were very hurt a lot immediately and across all those sectors that I mentioned. So mining, for instance, a burgeoning sector in Madagascar, that meant the ability to govern the mining sector went down, and the ability of operators in the mining sector that would do things either illicitly or in ways that are not best for the country, they could operate more freely because there was less oversight. How we deal with water sector, especially in the south, for instance, or health in water in the capital, really got hurt again very, very rapidly within a year. We saw a change in who was funding. So the World Bank was the largest donor in Madagascar before the 2009 crisis by quite a lot. What we saw instead was because they stepped out of the structural support for social sectors, for health and education, there was concern about the humanitarian impact of that, and UN agencies stepped in. So instead of development aid from the World Bank and European Union, we saw significant humanitarian aid step in that avoided the government entirely intervening at the local level, largely from UN agencies, also from USAID, that increased dramatically in 2010. So I want to say somewhere in the neighborhood of about 180 million to about 250 million in just a few months, and then increasing from there in order to make, in order to try to offset some of those humanitarian impacts. So when we speak to a 29% drop, it's impacted by those structural changes, as well as the move towards saying we're not going to put money into the government, we're not going to put money into developing a functioning healthcare sector, a functioning education sector, and the like. Instead, we're going to just make sure that local populations don't die, right? This sort of humanitarian aid. So these were very large impacts in a short period of time. And as I said before, I'm actually relatively impressed by how well Madagascar handled that change, as that was a very seismic impact.
And so let's fast forward a bit. I know you have a time limit here. So let's fast forward to Friday, January 17th of 2014, when Madagascar had a democratic election and we have a new president, there's talk now of new relations opening with the international community, which will be very positive, hopefully, for Madagascar. So let's talk about this a bit.
Sure. I'm going to go just a little bit before January 17th, because I think it's important to that there's some data that points out what was happening in the electorate during this time period of 2010 to 2013. And one of the changes that we see is a fractioning and a factionalizing of the electorate. So whereas in 2010, the thinking was there are these two leaders, there's Ravalomanana and there's Razwana, by 2012, that was really fractured. And there was no very clear singular leader. And the decision that neither of those protagonists would run in the election meant that really that factionalization would increase. And if we look at both polling data from that period, in particular in the capital, and then we also look at the results from the first round of elections, we see exactly that. We see no one taking any kind of dominant role in the election process during the first round, which was really a little bit scary, actually, that there was no coming together, right? So when you have two minority candidates coming in terms of electoral count, right? Minority candidates, neither of whom fared well outside of one part of the country. Go into the second round. It means that no matter who would win, they would come into power with a relatively weak base of power, and that's exactly what happened. I should add that at the time, the two candidates were seen as proxy candidates. So Ier Razwanan was seen as, you know, a proxy candidate for Razwanan, but he really, in a lot of ways, wasn't, right? That is, while there was that concern because he was a minister under Razwanan, that he really has demonstrated since January 17th that he's his own person, and especially with the appointment of the prime minister and decisions he made since, he's really acted to separate himself from the previous regime. And that's really quite important. Who knows what would have happened, had he not won, maybe we would have seen the same thing. Maybe we've seen a separation from Ravalomanana. But on the one hand, it's a time of great hope, because the international community is re-engaging, and they're re-engaging almost as quickly as they disengaged. The first thing was, right after the elections, almost immediately, the diplomatic community acted with pretty close to one voice in saying that they accept this election and they want to go ahead and work with Razwanan in order to move forward. And that also paved the way for the IMF coming in. And once the IMF came in, then it meant that the World Bank then reestablished. And so we were on a road to seeing a re-engagement from the donor community. And that's really necessary in a country that has been so aid dependent and that has such high needs, and in particular structural needs, and a need for engagement between the donor community on the one hand and the funding of structural reforms on the other. On the other hand, he has an almost impossible job. He, as I said, came in with a relatively weak power base. His political network is not particularly strong coming in. He's not the charismatic personality of those that preceded him. He has a reputation of being sort of a technocrat. He doesn't come from the provinces, but rather he comes from the capital region, as his two predecessors did, or his dual parentage, but at least he's thought of as coming from the capital. So he has a lot of struggles ahead of him, and it is really not clear that he can maintain power long enough in order to institute the sort of changes that have to happen to have a repetitive democratic cycle. So I think there's a large role for the international community to ensure that he produces results very quickly. That while the World Bank or others might be thinking structurally in the long term we need to do X, Y, Z, and they're right, in the concern for it is immediate, that he already, these few months into the political process of his leadership, is being called out as not making change fast enough. And so he needs to show results very, very quickly.
And has he expressed a vision for Madagascar yet, or is that sort of undefined?
You know, I think that's a really interesting point, that it's been a lot of years in Madagascar, I mean, decades really, in Madagascar since we've seen ideological difference. You know, as we look at who have been those vying for power, in the legislature for the most part, as well as for the presidency, it's a very liberal, economically speaking, a very liberal political culture, both locally and nationally. And the idea of that sort of economic engagement, both in the capital market domestically and internationally, is unchallenged. That is, no matter who would potentially be president of Madagascar. And I think we can take that backwards to the beginning of the Third Republic in the early 1990s. There was no ideological challenge and therefore the vision that each potential leader has created has been quite similar, actually, right? Re-engage the international community, focus on using different kinds of aid to achieve different kinds of purposes, ensure the private sector grows, focus on what export processing zones are doing and other kinds of opportunities for doing business, work with partners in order to grow that business, focus on both urban and rural sectors in complementary ways, be concerned with the environment sector, with the mining sector, and these sorts of distributional questions. Maybe the decisions about how jurisdictions work, whether there should be regions or whether there should be provinces or something else, how those should look might be different, but the vision that there needs to be sort of resolved to that is again something that is not challenged. That is, that any potential leader agrees with those elements, and further the need that there needs to be the recognition that there needs to be significant structural reforms addressing constitutional challenges that have still not really been addressed appropriately, party politics challenges, political network challenges. Every single potential leader speaks to these things. So when we speak to vision today, that's vision. And it's not unique to this leader, but that's vision of the presidency in general in Madagascar, with the undertone being development is key. Poverty alleviation is key. We need to move fast on poverty, and we need to move soundly on development. And the rest of it are technocratic questions, right? And that's something where the current president is quite strong. I mean, he's well-educated. He's a very sound policy thinker. So on the technocratic side, he's quite strong. On the setting of vision, I don't think he has distinguished himself. He's not done anything that would allow for the creation of a party platform, let's say. And he's not very charismatic to really create vision in that way. So that's why I go back to this idea that he needs time in order to build and show results, and the question is how does he have enough time to do that, and that's the concern moving forward.
And to conclude the conversation, because like I said, I know you have a time straight here. You've pretty much said a lot of what this reopening of international relations with Madagascar, as well as relations with the U.S. for Madagascar, that it's going to benefit them greatly in aid and bringing the country economically, hopefully, to a more stable position. But what would opened relations with Madagascar mean for the U.S.?
Yeah, I do want to make one more point on what it means for Madagascar, and then I'll answer that. That the loss of AGOA after the 2009 conflict was an enormous impact for Madagascar. And some economists have argued that it's the single largest impact on Madagascar, economically speaking, during the period of conflict. The immediate loss of 50,000 or so jobs of a particular caliber, the indirect loss of perhaps another 100,000 jobs of a particular caliber, have had a seismic impact on the economy of Madagascar and the functioning of both the, not just the textile sector, but how the export processing zones work and how trade functions. So that was a really big loss. So I don't want to lose that re-engagement with the U.S. brings about the possibility of the re-engagement of AGOA, which could be the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which could be very important for Madagascar. In the inverse, but important for both countries, I alluded to, but want to make sure I get back to, that this is a country that has seismic change in the mining sector and in general natural resource extraction sector. That's one of the biggest interests for the U.S. economically speaking. There's a lot of governance concern around it, but there's also a lot of opportunity around it as it's grown. The U.S. also sees two of its strategic areas at play in Madagascar. One is the rise of the illicit foresting of rosewood, starting in January of 2009 and exponentially growing during the period of conflict, has been a real concern for the U.S., for environmental concerns for Madagascar, but strategically as well. And so there's an opportunity to re-engage in that, and it's one of the things the current president is being criticized for, is not doing enough immediately. The second thing in that is the U.S. has had rising concerns about human trafficking. From a Malgash perspective, this is a U.S. concern, not a Malgash concern. But nonetheless, it's an opportunity for the U.S. to engage a country that they will find, where they will find an interlocutor on this question of human trafficking and find a partner. So on environmental concerns, on in particular forestry concerns, on natural resource extraction opportunities and human trafficking are all areas that we can expect to see increased interaction between the U.S. and Madagascar, hopefully to the benefit of both countries.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Marcus, and sharing this rich history and background and political story of Madagascar, and hopefully we'll be able to have you on the show again to continue this because it's very fascinating. So thank you so much for coming
on.
Great,
thank you. My pleasure.
And hopefully we'll talk to you soon.